I'm Don Swain. One of the men very much involved in the Watergate affair was Jeb Stuart Magruder, who was imprisoned for his part in the conspiracy. His book, In American Life, One Man's Road to Watergate, has just been reissued as a paperback. And I know that perhaps you're somewhat reluctant to go over all of this again. I know that you've had a number of interviews and this has been a problem, but I think since Watergate tends to blur, there were so many episodes and so many people involved that perhaps you could recap your specific involvement in the affair.
Well, primarily, in my case, I was involved in the basic Watergate conspiracy, which was the planning, the break-in, and then the cover-up of the Watergate break-in. I was deputy campaign manager of the Committee to Re-elect the President. John Mitchell and myself and John Dean were aware of Gordon Liddy's scheme to burglarize and wiretap the Democratic National Headquarters, and then after they were apprehended on June 17th, I was basically the, in a sense, the front man before the grand jury in attempting to cover up the actual Watergate scandal. I was not involved in the other peripheral activities like the plumbers and other activities which have become to be known as part of Watergate, but my role was primarily in the basic Watergate burglary.
Then you went to court, and what happened?
Well, I cooperated with the prosecution in April of 1973 and agreed to a one-count felony charge that carried a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and $10,000 fine. And in June of 1974, 14 months later, Judge Sirica sentenced me to 4 years in prison. Fortunately, in January 1975, Judge Sirica, for reasons that he has never made public, decided that the penalties that I had paid were sufficient, and he released myself, John Dean, and Herb Kalmbach, all on the same day, January 8th, 1975.
So how long did you actually...
I actually served 7 months, 8 days, and about 18 hours.
And this was in Allenwood?
Well, I was in Allenwood originally, but at the time I was released, because I was a witness in the Watergate trial, I was down at a maximum security safe house in Baltimore, Maryland.
What prompted you, what were your motivations in getting involved in the conspiracy?
Well, I think our motivation in getting involved in the conspiracy were simply an attempt to gather information. I don't think we put particularly any great emphasis on Mr. Liddy's activities. He had a massive scheme of intelligence. We only approved a small part of it, which was the wiretapping. And so consequently, we were really not, and it's hard to understand this in retrospect, but at the time that Liddy got involved in the break-in, we really weren't too concerned with that part of the campaign. It was a very minor part of the campaign, and we thought that if he could come up with some information that might be useful, that would be fine, but we didn't pay much attention to his activities. Of course, once the burglars were caught at the Watergate, then it became a major scandal, and then we became involved in trying to cover the scandal up.
And that was specifically your role?
Basically, my role was, since Mr. Liddy worked directly for me, for us to keep the scandal from rising above Mr. Liddy, I had to testify before the grand jury in the Watergate trial of the original Watergate 7, Liddy, Hunt, and the Cubans, and McCord, that the conspiracy stopped at Liddy.
Mr. Magruder, some time after the break-in, I recall John Mitchell saying that even though this happened, this possibly was all right because it did result in the re-election of the president. Was this paramount in the minds of the people at that time?
Well, I think there's no question that when the Watergate burglars were apprehended at the Democratic National Committee on June 17th, almost 3 years ago, the key reason, at least given to me by John Mitchell and by others in the White House, was that the reason we had to be sure that the Watergate was covered up was to be sure that President Nixon would be reelected. Now, at the same time, to be perfectly honest, I think you've got to realize that And not only were we protecting President Nixon, but we were protecting John Mitchell, we were protecting Bob Haldeman, we were protecting myself, John Dean, and many others.
What was there about the group of people, including yourself and the Nixon administration, that apparently made them so paranoid? I mean, why was it necessary to bug places?
I don't know. I think you've got to go back to the atmosphere that existed in the White House from the beginning. I joined the White House staff in October of 1969 as special assistant to the president, and I became immediately aware that the president himself, not only Bob Haldeman, not just John Mitchell, not just John Ehrlichman, but the president himself was interested in getting his enemies, not just outfoxing his enemies, but actually making sure that they didn't survive politically, and that he really wasn't too concerned about what means would be used to get those enemies. So consequently, when Liddy proposed his scheme 3 years later, and we were talking about wiretapping was something that had been used by the administration both legally and probably to some extent illegally before the Watergate break-in. As you know, the plumbers had broken into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist office, the same group basically, Liddy, Hunt, and the Cubans, approximately 6 months, I think, before that. So the atmosphere for these kind of activities was there long before any of us came up with this idea. And of course, I think Gordon Liddy, who was a prime conspirator in the planning stage, realized this and realized that there was an acceptable atmosphere for what he was talking about.
Were you aware of this type of atmosphere in the White House when you joined the Nixon staff?
Not when I joined the staff. I think I could say that I was aware that the president had certain feelings about the media, had certain feelings about the liberal Eastern establishment, but I didn't realize how intense they were and how he treated them as I said, like enemies. You know, Hubert Humphrey said a while ago that when you treat your political adversaries like enemies rather than like adversaries, you're probably going to have some problems. And I'm afraid that's really what happened. If we had treated them more as adversaries, people that we maybe disagreed with but respected, I think we would have been a lot better off.
Well, did you share the president's view before joining?
No, I had worked with the media before. Had many people that were friends of mine in the media. Like any other group of people, I think the media have their faults. I think they make many mistakes. But on the other hand, there were many people I thought very highly of and who I think have done a good job or did a good job. So I had no view of the media of any substance that was that negative in its approach. So I did not have that view when I joined the White House. But it was essential to survive in the White House structure for you to at least voice similar feelings about the media.
And you were determined to survive in that structure.
Well, I enjoyed working there. I had moved my family from Los Angeles at my expense. I had left the job. I had owned two corporations. I had sold my stock. And so I was very pleased to be in Washington. I liked what I was doing, and I accepted some of this attitude as being not necessarily productive, but if that's how the president felt, I guess I felt, who was I to be concerned about it? I think much of the same similar attitudes occurred during the Vietnam War and Johnson's administration, where many of the administration officials stayed on even after they had decided the Vietnam War was not or the approach the President Johnson was taking was not correct.
Mr. Magruder, tell us about Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Much has been said, written about them. Apparently they were fanatical in their devotion, loyalty to the president. Is this true?
Well, at least on the surface, one of the criteria which made it essential for success in the White House was primarily fostered more by Bob Haldeman, at least to my knowledge, than by John Ehrlichman, was this fanatical loyalty. One of the criteria when you work for Bob was that you did what he told you to do because that's what the president wanted done, and that was it. I mean, there were no questions asked. You didn't argue with Bob. You didn't discuss something. You did it. And And you did it on the basis of loyalty and on the basis of that was what the president wanted. I worked with Ehrlichman on a number of substantive issues and found John Ehrlichman to be a little easier and a little more reasonable to deal with on issues. But Bob was the key man in the White House. Bob was the chief of staff. Bob was the man who was with the president the most. And consequently, I think for all White House staffers, you had to relate to Haldeman if you were going to be successful in the White House.
Well, prior to the Senate hearings and various court testimony, Haldeman and Ehrlichman came across like ogres, but subsequently they seemed to be regular guys, with Haldeman letting his hair grow longer and the big smile and this sort of thing. So how did you find them personally?
Well, it has been somewhat amusing to me to particularly watch Bob Haldeman in this sense, because when I knew Bob, when I worked for Bob...
Did he hire you?
Yes, he hired me. He did not suffer fools lightly. Consequently, you either did your job, you either performed the way he wanted you to perform, or you didn't stay in the White House. And many people are examples that left the White House staff, went on to other government positions, or actually left the government because Bob didn't feel they were performing their functions effectively. So to see Bob now on television as an example, as a friendly, pleasant, easygoing person, is difficult for me, who used to work for him, to put the two images together. One is inconsistent. My guess is, and I don't mean this in any way of inferring any lack of concern for his future, because I feel sorry for everyone who's been involved in Watergate, is I think the real Bob Haldeman is the one I knew back in the White House. I don't think it is the one that we are seeing on television now. Ehrlichman, although he was extremely abrasive at the Senate Watergate committees, when I dealt with him in the White House, was easier to deal with, was more reasonable in the sense of being willing to discuss give you a chance to state your case if you had a point of view. He then became extremely abrasive, as you remember, in the Senate Watergate committees. Subsequent to that, I think since the trial, has attempted in his own way to try to redeem himself by offering alternative service to prison by helping the Navajo Indians, I think, in New Mexico.
Mr. Magruder, what about Richard Nixon himself? Did you get to know him well during your period in the White House? And what was he like? How did he behave toward you?
I don't think very many people at my level, which would be the second level of the staff at the White House, got to know him well personally. In fact, probably not too many of the senior staff people got to know him well personally. He did not socialize with the staff. I don't know of too many people who saw him on a, what I would call, a social basis.
Did Richard Nixon ever walk down the hall, put his arm around you, and say, "You're doing a great job, Jed"?
Well, he did talk about how good a job I was doing a number of times. In fact, early in the tapes, and the famous tapes that had been released, when I was still covering up the Watergate, he talked about how good a job I was doing. And on numerous occasions, I remember after the inaugural, which I ran, and after the election and after other events that were successful, he mentioned to me how pleased he was with the work I was doing. But I can't say that I knew him on a personal basis. I saw him in meetings. I saw him at events. I saw him in a staff capacity. Except for Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, Henry Kissinger, a few of the other senior staff aides who dealt directly with him on a one-on-one basis. Very few of us ever dealt with him on a one-on-one basis.
This is Crosstalk on CBS FM. We're talking to Jeb Stuart Magruder, who has written a book called An American Life, One Man's Road to Watergate. It's been reissued as a paperback. What was life like in the White House itself? Now, when Lyndon Johnson was there, people lived in fear that he would be shouting at them. What was Richard Nixon like in this regard?
Well, because of his desire to really work very singularly and very much on his own, and to work off of decision papers, you didn't really have to worry too much about Richard Nixon, because he didn't really bother you. it was primarily Bob Haldeman who was in control of the process by which material got to the president. And so, as an example, Bob Haldeman would meet with Richard Nixon every morning, and they would go over the previous day's events and what would be planned for the day, the upcoming day. And if there were things that the president wanted done, he told Bob Haldeman he wanted them done. Then Bob would transmit those things to whichever staff people he felt could accomplish, you know, those activities. And when I was there, much of it was in the public relations area, which I was involved in. So each morning I could always count on a flood of instructions coming across from Bob saying, we have to do this or that or whatever it was relating to the media, relating to various and sundry things in what I call a general public relations field. And most of the time I was in the White House, I was the deputy director of the communications department working for Herb Klein. But Bob dealt directly with me, and Herb was used more by the White House as a spokesman rather than as a manager, and I was basically the manager of the communications effort. And Bob would give us these assignments, and we had to get them done and get information usually back to the president, usually within a day or at most a day or two. Fortunately, there were times when we had the opportunity to work on long-range programming and long-range efforts to communicate the president's programs to the public. But most of the time, I remember, were spent on crisis situations where some commentator or someone else had done something the president didn't care for, and we had to try to come up with some method of counteracting the negative publicity that had ensued.
Why did you want to go into government? You were a businessman. Certainly it would be not economically as viable to go into government. You had a financial move from California. Why did you wish to do?
Took a good pay cut at the same time.
Right.
Well, I had been involved in volunteer politics since 1960, since the first Nixon campaign and for the presidency. Had worked in congressional campaigns and gubernatorial campaigns, and had the proverbial political bug. I've known lots of people who, once they got involved in political campaigns, have become so enamored with politics that they do anything to continue in politics, and I'm sure I was in that category. I loved it.
Did you feel a call to follow Richard Nixon, or was it just government in general?
It was. I didn't really know Richard Nixon when I went to the White House, and consequently I think it was more a call to work for the government, to work for the political party that I felt most comfortable with, and it was exciting.
Would you describe yourself as a conservative, as Richard Nixon is?
I hate that term, conservative or liberal, because I don't really think they explain what your views might be on particular issues, but certainly I would have fallen in the moderate conservative spectrum. I've worked for liberal candidates, I've worked for conservative candidates, but probably politically I was in the moderate conservative element, and politics was just very very exciting, very interesting. And even though I had to take a pay cut and move my family to go to the White House to work at the highest levels of the government, seemed at that time to be very important.
Would you want to do it again?
Absolutely not.
I'd like to know about the impact of Watergate on you personally. First, what happened after you were sentenced to jail? You walked in, I don't know if the door clanked shut, but nevertheless there was a feeling of captivity. How did you react to this?
Well, it was, for me, and I'm sure for any prisoner who would speak honestly, a prison, and any prison, I don't care if it's a minimum security prison called the country clubs of the prison system, which they aren't, or a maximum security prison, are very depressing, difficult places for anyone who has a mind that is logical and thinks in terms of working and getting a job done and going through a day with some satisfaction. Because in prison, you have absolutely no ability to achieve anything or to feel that your time is being spent in any way, in any worthwhile fashion. So, consequently, prisons are exceptionally depressing places where the inmates, the guards, and the whole prison society is living in an atmosphere of fear, hostility, tension.
What kind of inmates did you come in contact with?
Well, you know, there is a fallacy that the minimum security prisons in the United States are sort of country clubs where the white-collar prisoner goes, and that just isn't true. At Allenwood Prison Camp, where I was first incarcerated, only, say, 10% of the 400 inmates were white, were what I would call white-collar prisoners. The rest of the prisoners were street criminals who had been convicted of street crimes. They were the complete mixture of the prison population in total.
How did they react to you knowing your notoriety?
Well, the thing that they couldn't understand, which was always the funniest part of prison, was that they couldn't understand why I hadn't financially benefited, because most people who are in prison because they're pushing drugs, or they've robbed a bank, or they've done something to financially benefit themselves. And so they always had a hard time understanding why I was so stupid as not to have at least made some efforts to at least remunerate my criminal efforts.
And wasn't there some petty cash floating around the White House? Didn't John Dean finance his honeymoon on that?
John did finance his honeymoon, I guess, on that. He did pay it back. In the prison vernacular, that would have been a very petty kind of activity, though. And as far as I know, we've all undergone the most extensive investigation probably that any group of individuals have in this country. And as far as I know, they've not found any financial wrongdoing with our activities. So that was the difficult part other prisoners had in understanding why we were involved in Watergate, because they didn't understand the aspects of the presidency or the loyalty factor.
What about the prison authorities and the guards? How did they treat you like every other
prison? In prison, the guards and the administration are sort of over here on one side, and the prisoners are over on another side, and never the twain shall meet. There is a caste system in prison, and there's very little communication between the guards and the prisoners of any substance. So I can't say I had much communication other with a man I worked with who was a general foreman, and that was pleasant. And I was a clerk during most of my time in prison, and I did as much as I could do to keep busy. There really wasn't much to do there. Nobody really works very hard in prison because there really isn't much there.
Mr. Magruder, Jimmy Breslin has written a book, which you may have read, How the Good Guys Finally Won, and there's an incident in which you're said to have approached former New Jersey Congressman Cornelius Gallagher. He was in jail for income tax evasion, and you're quoted as asking Gallagher's help in smearing Peter Rodino, who was the head of the impeachment committee, and you imply, you're quoted as saying that Richard Nixon could give Gallagher a pardon if Gallagher could help wipe out Rodino. What's the truth about that?
This is one of the kind of problems I'm afraid most of us will face for a period of time, certainly. You can just about say anything against the Watergate figure and probably get away with it. And Jimmy Breslin has used probably this kind of cheap journalism to make a point in his book, which has turned out to be his biggest selling point for his book. The fact is that Jimmy Breslin isn't quoting Neil Gallagher. Jimmy Breslin is quoting Peter Rodino, who quotes Tip O'Neill, who quotes Congressman John Murphy, who quotes Neil Gallagher, who quotes me. Now, that's five times removed from the source. Now, most news people that I know will not print a story unless it's at least verified by one of the two sources of the story. That would be Mr. Gallagher, ex-Congressman Gallagher, or myself. Mr. Breslin didn't bother about checking with Mr. Gallagher or with myself. Newsweek, as an example, a reputable magazine supposedly, didn't bother checking with Mr. Gallagher or myself and printed the story and then editorialized on it. Time magazine did the same thing.
Are you saying that your Watergate activity stopped as soon as you went into
prison? Well, just let's look at it in a sense from a logical standpoint. In January of 1973, I had my last conversation with Richard Nixon. In March of 1973, I resigned from the April, actually. I agreed to cooperate with the prosecution. And in the tapes that were published record of the president's discussions with Bob Haldeman at that time, President Nixon basically called me almost every four-letter word in the book, because I was cooperating with the prosecution. I had no further contact with the Nixon hierarchy from that time until I entered prison. In fact, I think probably if he had a new enemies list, John Dean and I would have been on the top of that enemies list. Secondly, I had agreed to cooperate with the prosecution, and my activities had to be completely along the lines of giving them information which would later bring the trial of Bob Haldeman, John Mitchell, and others. For anyone then to think that I would go into prison, having publicly stated on a number of television shows also that that I thought Richard Nixon had to go through the judicial and congressional process that we had gone through, and that if he was guilty of crimes, as we had been found guilty of crimes, that then he had to be impeached. So to think that with all of that background, I would then go into prison attempting to make some agreement with a congressman or an ex-congressman, Neil Gallagher, that I didn't even know. Jimmy Breslin says, I played tennis with him the first day. I did not play tennis with him for a number of weeks. I knew him slightly. I had conversations with him on general subjects. I cannot recall any subject matter that would even remotely relate to what Breslin is talking about. But I think what Jimmy Breslin has done, I think what Newsweek has done, is here's a Watergate guy. His veracity can be questioned, so I'll publicize my book and I'll make my best story in my book based on something that I haven't even checked out.
What has the experience of prison done to you emotionally, psychologically?
Well, I've felt afterwards, and I've thought about this a lot, that anybody who says that prison was a good experience, or I came out of prison fine, is, I think, kidding themselves. You just don't come out of that kind of atmosphere without having a real feeling of really sorrow, in a sense, something that I wasn't aware of to the degree I am now, I think, of how our country treats the underprivileged, the lower third of our socioeconomic scale, in the sense that most prisoners are in that category. And there is no redeeming value in prison. There is no rehabilitation. There is no attempt to help the person make it in society. Prison is simply punishment.
Well, let me, we're almost out of time, but I would like to ask you, what about your family? How did they survive or react during
the period? Again, and one of the great difficulties for all prisoners is how to handle the family, because they have not committed the crime, and here they are suffering probably to a great extent, maybe to a greater extent than the prisoner is. It was very hard on my family. My wife is a private person. Here she was, not only was her husband in prison, but she was undergoing all this publicity. The children, of course, no children, I think, can comprehend why their father is in prison. Fortunately, she visited every week, brought the children with her, and so we kept our relationship very strong, and I think in a sense it helped our marriage. But I'm sure...
But the kids had trouble in school.
Oh, they had some problems, but the kids on the whole in school were great to them, and they've done very well, continue to do well in school. So fortunately, we seem to be coming out of it well, I hope.
What about you now? How are you surviving? What is your income? Do you have a job?
Well, I don't have any income yet. I'm still unemployed, but I do have a number of job offers. And I think within the next couple of weeks, I will accept one of the job offers and hopefully get settled and have Watergate behind me.
Still living in California?
No, I'm living in Washington still. We stayed in Washington, and I probably will accept a job that will require us to move out of
Washington. Very quickly, are you bitter, angry, resigned, or what?
Well, it really would be a waste of psychic energy to be bitter and angry at this stage. I think now it's just to forget as much as I can about Watergate and get on with the life of living.
Thank you very much, Jeb Stuart Magruder, once the deputy director of the committee to re-elect the president, one of many Nixon people involved in the Watergate scandal. His book, An American Life, One Man's Road to Watergate, has been reissued in paperback. This is Don Swaim for Crosstalk.